This is the Infotagen podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. In 1995, Craig Newmark launched Craigslist, which became a global online community where people could share ideas and information, as well as promote products and services. Today, through Craig Newmark Philanthropies, he supports projects and organisations that promote quality journalism and investigative reporting. I'm Damian Collins, and I'll be joined on this Infotagen podcast by Craig Newmark, where we'll be discussing how social media has become weaponized by bad actors, including foreign states, to spread hate and division, and what can both the tech companies and governments do to address this. We'll also be hearing from our resident disinformation analyst, Dr. Charles Creel. Craig Newmark, it's fantastic to have you on the Infotagen podcast. A lot of what we've discussed on this podcast has been looking at the impact of disinformation on society, particularly in the context of a global pandemic. And it seems to me, and I'd be interested in your views on this too, that people have really started to focus on disinformation on social media when it's affecting public health, when it's affecting the information people get about whether to take a vaccine or not, when we've got one, and how to keep themselves safe. And disinformation in that way outside the political context seems to be something people have focused on a lot more. And I wondered if that's been your experience looking at these issues as well recently.
Well, what I've seen is that, our shared adversaries, whether foreign and domestic, seek to destabilize our respective countries. One way that they're doing that is by seeding organizations of so-called fellow travelers to transmit and to amplify disinformation about vaccines, about the pandemic, and a lot of other areas. This has been succeeding. Both our countries have been destabilized in terms of our democracies, and in the U.S., we face a major test of this in around 80 days.
I think this is a really interesting point because there's been some good analysis done showing that the sorts of groups that engage in disinformation about COVID have also been engaged in disinformation around Black Lives Matters, other political topics as well. They shift from topic to topic and pick the ones where they think they can sow the greatest amount of division. And of course, that's even more concerning if these are foreign states and other bad actors who are doing this.
Yeah. When the security researchers do the proper attribution research, they find that there are plenty of domestic partners of our shared adversaries, but they all have one real overreaching goal: to destabilize our cultures and then to place assets in high positions. That's been working. We're hoping in the U.S. for a major reversal of that during our current election season. And our election season starts shortly and is expected to run probably well into November.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that anything fundamentally has changed between now and 2016 in that the sort of tactics that were deployed then to divide communities, suppress voting, do you think those tactics could be run again? Or do you think enough's been done to try and stop it?
The same tactics are being run again. One difference appears to be that our adversaries have been much more effective in making use of their domestic partners in amplifying disinformation. That's a big threat, and apparently in both our countries.
When you say they're domestic supporters, the domestic allies, who do you mean by that?
Well, in the U.S., there's a number of organizations that have been pretty active spreading disinformation. We have one party in this country doing that. There are a number of extremist groups. Usually they're xenophobic. Typically, if you find a group which is anti-immigrant, that's an issue which is only a front issue for what used to be and are now called, again, fellow travelers, spreading a message from our foreign adversaries.
Now, one of the things that really struck me when we ran the Select Committee inquiry on disinformation, and in particular, we asked Facebook about the 2016 American election,
was the sense that Facebook didn't really feel it had any obligation to look out for foreign interference, even if that meant people buying ads from another country to target Americans, which is an offense, criminal offense. And does that surprise you? Do you think there is an issue here that the companies still don't really feel that it's their job to look out for this kind of stuff?
Well, this is an evolution of positions. I can say even firsthand that no one expects the ill uses of what should be good connections, which connect people. No one anticipated that. It's easy then to rationalize what you're doing about it or not doing about it. At some point, you can fully embrace trying to counter a lot of bad actions, but the bad actors involved are very smart and are highly well-funded and have friends in very high places. So even as the big platforms and mass media seek to deal with disinformation, it's a really difficult problem. Machine learning isn't up to the solution yet. It may be in some years, perhaps only several years. But a bigger problem is that sometimes people running media platforms, social media or newspapers, they fear retaliation on the part of the domestic allies of foreign bad actors, because the highly placed assets do have the means to disrupt the activities of social media platforms or newspapers. Currently, there's an ongoing threat in the U.S. on the part of alleged conservatives to attempt to interfere with what social media platforms are doing.
And their argument on that seems to be that they believe that the pressure on social media companies to do more to act against harmful disinformation is reducing the share of voice for conservative voices. And do you think that is, what's your response to that?
There are two movements in Washington and elsewhere. One is that social media platforms, and maybe all platforms on the net, should should discourage fraud and disinformation and anything that feels like what my Sunday school teachers called false witness or bearing false witness. And I adopt that position. Then there are other voices in Washington and else who, when they see the social media platforms discouraging fraud and false witness against alleged conservatives, they complain about that. But what we're just talking about is reducing fraud and false witness and harmful disinformation, and no actual conservatives are being attacked.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand the point that it could be difficult for a company like Facebook to police everything that anyone says on Facebook at any one time. But it seems to me the real area of harm is when the tools that they've created are being used to amplify and boost those messages, either through their own recommendation or indeed through targeting tools. And there's been, you know, good analysis done showing that Facebook ad targeting tools have been used to target people who might be Nazi sympathizers or hold racist views. And the company surely can't have a defense in that situation when its own tools are being used to try and deliberately target people who might be interested in hate messages.
Well, these are really, really difficult problems. And en masse, the solution will probably come from machine learning. Again, that's a future. In the here and now, there are means by which the platforms can discourage disinformation, because some of the worst sources of disinformation are fairly obvious. The platforms are taking action against some of them, but they don't have the will yet to take on the high-placed assets of our foreign adversaries, both countries, since they're very well entrenched and have violent associates.
Do you think that's a really powerful and interesting point, that do you think they're intimidated against taking more action against the sources of this disinformation, particularly if it's coming from, say, sources in Russia or Iran or countries like that?
Well, in the U.S., there's been the beginning of violence against parties who act in good conscience to tell the truth. That's only beginning. The violence so far is mostly informational, although there have been some episodes of physical violence, say at rallies. In the UK, I understand that there are parties who've had adventures with Polonium or Novichok if they've sought to act in good conscience. This is a big problem in both countries. I'm more actively involved in the U.S., but somewhat international. At the very least, I'm working with groups like the International Women's Media Fund to find constructive approaches to, well, to take the battle to the enemy when it comes to attacks against journalists. First, mostly focusing on women journalists, they take the brunt of the harassment.
And I mean, when we look at some of this harmful content out there and the way it's targeted at people, I also think it's, you know, I don't think we should accept that we should live in a world where people's engagement with each other through social media also comes with a load of hate speech, racist language, anti-Semitic language, bullying and intimidation, that we just seem to have being asked to accept that this is, well, this is just, people have a right to say what they like, and therefore this is just the way of the world now. I don't really see why the world has to be like that, or we should accept it. And do you feel that the sort of First Amendment defense that the social media companies use, that they can't regulate speech, is that good enough? Do you think they're right in their interpretation of it?
Well, the First Amendment affects the U.S. government. That is, the U.S. government cannot conduct censorship, but a social media platform or a newspaper, at least in the U.S., those are private property. They can do what they want. I agree with the free speech bias, but yelling fire in a crowded auditorium, that's not free speech. Fraud is not free speech. Disinformation is not free speech. So when bad actors whose job is to commit fraud, to commit disinformation, to bear false witness, when they do those things, those are not matters of free speech at all. And detecting them all is very difficult, but the worst cases are very obvious.
Do you think Mark Zuckerberg will end up doing more than he's prepared to do at the moment? Do you think the debate is pushing him along, and particularly the concern around medical disinformation linked to COVID is pushing him into making decisions he wouldn't have made before?
I think the people who work for Mark are pushing in that direction, a direction of good conscience. I've had to make some decisions, and I'm driven by what I learned in Sunday school from Mr. and Mrs. Levin. They told me, they had it on good authority, that bearing false witness is bad. And they have some really big guys backing them on this.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, now, there was a time when people might...
When I root to the really big guys, I am not taking the piss.
No. Do you think the problems are made worse today because there was a time when social media sat within a multimedia landscape, and people may see things on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube, but they also watch the network television news, and they read newspapers, both local and national, certainly in the UK. But actually, the loss of ad revenue from traditional media to the big social media companies, particularly to Google and Facebook, has really hollowed out news and press. And I know you do a lot through your philanthropic network to support journalism and quality journalism, which is so important, I think, in a democracy, that we have that challenging voice that comes from journalists to keep us on the straight and narrow. But we seem to be moving into a world where journalism is being hollowed out because of a massive decline in revenues, at the same time when social media is becoming increasingly people's main point of reference and the lens through which they see the world. And what do you think we can do about the way these two things have really crashed together and potentially could create one of the biggest challenges to democracy that we've seen since the Second World War?
Well, there's a whole range of activities, and I speak in some ignorance here because my specialty does not include business models. I intuit that the role of advertising is already greatly diminishing. And frankly, I prefer models of sponsorship, membership, and mixes of models where if you want media, you could either accept ads or pay a little bit for there are no ads to be there. I like sponsorship and membership models where a small number of sponsors or members can pay for free media for all. That's the model in the U.S. for national public radio, for example, and for a national public TV. So things are rebalancing right now. Advertising is becoming less and less important over time. And again, I'd like to pay for all my media, and for the most part, I do. There's room for advertising as well. But while that's going on, I figure I should play a role supporting public media in large amounts, indirectly, directly, in the amounts of tens of millions of dollars, trying to make it free for folks. I'm also addressing local media, which is of vital importance in a democracy. And I have focused on a couple of so-called news deserts where there's insufficient local news. The best and most ironic example is New York City.
Right.
So I've contributed there, for example, to WNYC, to a new newspaper called thecity.nyc, to an offshoot of public radio called Gothamist. I'm wearing their T-shirt now, which features the Mandarin duck, because Gothamist has an excellent vermin beat. And I'm very fond of Pizza Rat. No one knows what's happened to Mandarin duck, but I'm sure he was delicious.
But I mean, is your concern, though, that the support for journalism may end up becoming a part of the work of philanthropic organizations because commercially it may be difficult to make enough money out of pure journalism in order to make titles self-sustaining? Except, of course, I mean, the big media brands like the New York Times or the Times in London, they seem to be making a good go now of sort of paid for journalism online. But smaller news organizations are finding it very hard. And do you think this is going to be a new factor in news, that it'll need external support?
I think we're seeing a rebalancing where I hope that the most successful news organizations make do with a combination that favors both large-scale philanthropic support plus membership support with sponsorship, which is a kind of advertising, and with conventional ads.
Yeah.
As I say this, I realize I think we are already seeing a rebalancing, and that's the direction I think I'd like to see the industry moving in, with sufficient attention paid to the ethics of funding nonprofit journalism. I work with the American Press Institute, which published some very good work along those lines. And I've committed to their principles and some more. For example, if I help fund a news organization, I know not to expect pre-publication review. Hmm. I might go so far as to point out a potential story, but that's pretty much as far as I could do. I'm a big supporter of Wikipedia. Wikipedia is where facts go to live, and I'm a heavy contributor there, but there I have to follow community standards. And even when I see an error in my own bio, I have to follow really rigorous rules in order to get anything corrected. You may find the same thing.
Yeah.
And I do regard Wikipedia as a form of journalism, in some respects, the most important form.
Yeah. I mean, you were with Craigslist, I mean, I suppose one of the pioneers of the idea of the internet being a space where communities could organize and gather, not just where people went to go and seek information or seek to buy things, yeah, but where networks that would bring people together with shared and common interests. I mean, you started Craigslist when Mark Zuckerberg was still in high school, I guess, probably when he maybe younger than that. Looking at what sort of community life has become like on social media now, I mean, are we now where you thought we would be? I mean, if social media has become the town square of the world, What sort of state do you think that square is today?
I think social media is collectively the town square of the world. Mm. It is overshadowed in the news by what bad actors are doing with it. Mm. But I routinely see, let's say in neighborhood mailing lists, people helping each other find lost cats.
Yeah.
People sharing information about the unexpected thunderstorm that passed through San Francisco days ago. And sometimes in social media, in neighborhood groups, people ask the classic question, what's that smell? Remember, there are far more bad actors, far more good actors, people of good conscience on social media, but we've evolved to notice the threats to us. That's why we see what people of bad conscience are doing.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think one of the big differences between now and say 2016 is that we've begun to understand the questions that we should be asking and the things that we should look out for in a way that we just weren't before. But we're going through a period where political debate seems to be getting more extreme. The language that is used in politics is getting more extreme. Maybe that's down to one or two leading politicians, but it nevertheless certainly seems to be a fact. Is we are living also through very challenging times. What do you think is happening here? Is the tail wagging the dog? Is the exploitation of social media making people angrier, or is it simply reflecting the world as people really see it?
Our shared foreign adversaries have used polarization as a means of weakening both our countries, of destabilizing both countries, and others like Ukraine, Italy, Hungary. The polarization is deliberate. Our foreign adversaries find domestic partners who can profit by polarizing their countries. And in some cases, our foreign adversaries have won victories. In some cases, they've won the war. And so their domestic partners are the drivers of polarization. But our foreign adversaries play a role, and they've been using these strategies for well over a century.
Do you think their activity is has played a big role in making the world an angrier place?
Yes. Anger is a profit. And when things are destabilized, when things slide in all directions, that presents great opportunities for both good actors and bad actors. Chaos is a ladder. And I realize that I'm quoting Game of Thrones, but that's the most eloquent description of the intended effects of destabilization. In the US and UK, our foreign adversaries have won considerable victories. And I do know in the U.S., we're fighting back, and I'm hoping for a mighty victory in election season. But my optimism is cautious.
I mean, do you think the tech companies could be doing more to de-escalate this, if you like, to try and... Because, I mean, it seemed to me that to fight this battle, if we think social media is one of the big battlegrounds, without the support of particularly the big American companies that are so important in this battle, it's going to be much harder for us.
On the social media side, I think people in the highest office are beginning to understand the ramifications of what they've done. Mm. Their employees are telling them that. That's also true in mass media. There, the issue is that reporters, journalists don't want to amplify disinformation. They are now having a hard time convincing their editors and publishers, since the editors and publishers find news of polarization profitable. But there are people, including me, who are reminding them that journalism ethics prohibits the amplification of disinformation. Mm. Specifically, the ethics of news distribution prohibits that. And news distribution is something done not only by newspapers, but by social media platforms. Me, again, now and then I remind them of what I learned in Sunday school. It is bad to bear false witness.
Yeah. Do you, looking at the election in November, Joe Biden's been quite critical of Facebook, has issued public challenges to Facebook about the need for them to do more to stop people using political ads on social media to spread lies. I remember watching the first Senate hearing with Mark Zuckerberg, and I thought Kamala Harris was one of the asked some of the best questions, some of the toughest questions of Mark Zuckerberg in that hearing. If we have a kind of Biden-Harris government in America next year, do you think there's going to be a big change in approach and policy towards the tech companies?
I think we're going to see a fair approach to big tech companies. For example, they at least should deal with the easy cases of mass disinformation and accelerate development of machine learning to deal with bad situations. I have a lot of confidence in Kamala based on working with her intermittently over a period of about 15 years, starting when she was the DA of San Francisco. Mm. At that point, she wanted me to validate a hunch that the city of San Francisco had bought the wrong email system. And I believe that the error was corrected not long after that meeting.
Yeah.
I have a lot of confidence in people who I think will take other high office, perhaps Secretary of the Treasury. I've worked with Elizabeth Warren for some time, like with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is basically an anti-corruption agency in the U.S.
Do you think, I mean, you're very much part of the, you know, senior echelons of the tech community in California. There's this, the debate around technology and its role in society, I think it's been amplified in the last couple of years. Some people interpret that as a kind of anti-tech agenda. But do you think people within the community you're part of see this as, you know, see these as problems that can be solved and ultimately will be solved, and shouldn't be in any ways a barrier to the development of tech and the positive role it can play in society?
I think the discussion is overall healthy, with the exception of false claims of censorship and bias against alleged conservatives.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Charles Creel's been listening in on the discussion, and Charles, it's good to have you with us, as always, on the podcast.
Thanks, Simeon.
What's caught your attention over the last couple of weeks?
What I've really been looking at, I mean, a lot is happening this week, including the Democratic Convention in the United States, but it's really hard to ignore that the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence this week has released their fifth and the final report on Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. It's absolutely electrified the entire counter-disinformation community, if such a thing can be said to exist out there. The report was the result of a bipartisan investigation, and it lasted 3.5 years, examined more than 1 million documents, and took evidence from over 200 witnesses. And as we said, it's the final volume, volume 5 of their inquiry, and it came in at 966 pages, which is an awful lot of information for the world to process. It documents extensive contacts between the Trump campaign and Russian operatives in the months before the 2016 election, and overall it concluded that Russia meddled in that election, and they continue to do so. Now, there are a few key takeaways from the document, and understand that it's been out less than 24 hours. One is a demonstration of strong links between Trump's then-campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, and Konstantin Kilimnik, who we now know is a Russian intelligence officer. Their relationship was longstanding. It grew out of Manafort's relationships with Russian and Ukrainian oligarchs. But the report also records that Manafort was highly willing to share information with Kilimnik, as well as Oleg Deripaska, a Russian oligarch and industrialist, and that it represented a grave counterintelligence threat, which is strong language when you're speaking about the chairman of the RNC's presidential political campaign. The report also documented a robust network between Roger Stone, Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, and members of the Trump campaign. the Trump campaign was unabashedly enthusiastic about WikiLeaks releasing weaponized campaign information. And we know now that that was obtained by Russian intelligence services. And what we're talking about here is the collection of the DNC's Democratic National Committee's emails stolen by hackers operating under the pseudonym Guccifer 2.0. But working for the FSB. And that Stone was directly in contact with Trump and promising additional information useful to the campaign, and that the campaign welcomed that information. There were other conclusions as well in the report, and they don't necessarily back an anti-Trump narrative. This report differs from the Mueller report, for example, in that it didn't look at criminality, but rather at counterintelligence concerns, and it deems the Mueller report focused too narrowly on criminality. But they also called the Steele dossier into question in the report, suggesting the FBI might have been the victim of a disinformation operation. And in fact, this 1,000-page document is riddled with references to Steele's dossier. The report also doesn't use the word collusion. But here, it's really worth noting, Damian, that the acting chair of the Intelligence Committee since May of this year has been conservative Republican Mark Rubio. And what I mean by pointing that out is that Rubio has come in at the tail end of the report with a very strong level of influence over the published contents. Now, despite this, the report does conclude Russia's interference in the U.S. election is real and is ongoing, and that it's vital that the public position themselves as informed information consumers. And I'll also note there's extensive information throughout the document, both about the Steele dossier, but also about Cambridge Analytica and links between the Trump campaign and several foreign countries and international organizations. But I'll have to say that at 995 pages, I might have to save an in-depth analysis for another episode.
I've read the reporting on this. There are Senate Republicans who have provided pretty solid evidence of the Trump campaign working with Russian intelligence and so on. And I admire the courage of the Republican senators who stood up for this. I know that there's been some attempts to walk it back. But still, this is a rare act of courage, which we should respect.
I think that's absolutely true. And I find it interesting, both some of the conclusions in the report, also its publication this week, especially as the DNC are holding their convention. And if everything is a text to be read, my reading of this text is that the support for Trump is waning significantly.
Well, we're living in interesting times, and representatives of the U.S. intelligence services have always maintained that there was a lot of improper connection between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence. I know very little on the UK side. I've met people from GCHQ socially, but it's limited to that. And I'm only concerned with that because they seem to oppose some of the work done by Sir Harry Pierce at MI5.
Well, I mean, it's extraordinary in a way. I think we've seen this with the Senate report and also with the Russia report published by the Senate, by the UK Intelligence and Security Committee, that somehow it seems to be political to even acknowledge the fact the Russians are trying to interfere. And you think in another era, we would have said, okay, well, let's acknowledge this is going on and let's develop a strategy to counter this. But even the existence of this threat seems to be denied by people because of its political connotations.
That's right. If you've emotionally invested in someone who is known to be an asset of a foreign intelligence service, it's hard to admit to yourself that you've been made a fellow traveler. And worse, if you know what the other euphemism is for a fellow traveler.
Do you think we'll see more shenanigans during the remaining weeks of the election campaign? There was the Twitter hack recently, where probably a load of direct messages will have been scraped by the hackers to be deployed at some point. Do you think we'll see more things like the sort of email hack with Hillary Clinton that was released during the final weeks of the campaign. Do you think we should be looking out for things like that?
Well, bad actors in high office have already come out and admitted that they're trying to disrupt the election. They're trying to rig it. And fortunately, a lot of vigilance regarding the U.S. Post Office may have averted a fair amount of that, which I appreciate.
Sorry, go on.
I do know much less about the UK situation, and I really should know more. I only have questions about the matters in the UK. For example, will there be another season of Killing Eve? and also, since I do watch a great deal of British TV, I'm not convinced that Matthew McFadden and Rupert Penryn-Jones are those two separate people or one guy with two different acting styles. I would like these addressed.
I think this is a really important question. I'm just trying to think, have they ever appeared in the same thing together? I'm not sure they have.
Yeah, and if you could open up an inquiry, a formal inquiry into that, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think these are very important important issues. I think because Phoebe Waller-Bridge has kind of like shared the writing of Killing Eve, it makes it more likely there'll be another series of Killing Eve.
Thank you. I'm greatly comforted. Also, how long can Bernard Cornwell continue writing the Saxon Chronicles?
I think there's no end to that, and I'm sure probably like Ian Fleming, there'll be kind of other people will pick up the mantle even when he's unable to do it.
And I think it's Bill James writes the excellent Eels and Harper police procedurals. If you could encourage him to write more, I would appreciate that.
We'll certainly pass that on. I'm sure they'll be listening to the podcast and they'll pick that up directly. But if not, we'll follow it up. I mean, this
please
is
leave all that. Podcast.
Oh, we certainly will. Don't worry about that. But as we sort of coming towards the end of our discussion for the podcast, we've had a lot of discussion on the problems, where we see the problems as lying. If it was down to you, if it was solely your decision about what to do, what would you do to try and put these things right?
I would basically, if they're in some big areas, I would highly finance crash projects in machine learning. Ironic, because that's something I wanted to go into 45 years ago, but it wasn't ready. Mm. And I would try to give people who run platforms and newspapers the moral courage to at least deal with the major cases of bearing false witness.
And are you optimistic we will get this right?
I'm cautiously optimistic because I see some of the major voices in honest journalism standing up more loudly in recent days even.
Good. Well, that's a positive note on which to end. But as you said earlier on, I think the good thing is that I think we're focusing on the right issues and having the right debates about them, and that will shape policy. I said that was the last thing, but one final thing I do want to ask about, because it's particularly relevant to the debate we're having in the UK and in other countries as well, and something we've talked about a lot on the podcast, do you think that ultimately getting this right, having the right level of responsibility for companies to act on the most harmful forms of content, do you think that will ultimately require some sort of external regulation or some external laws that require that, or do you think the companies will ever get to a place where they willingly and effectively police themselves?
I'm hoping that self-policing will be driven by the need for sites to be advertiser safe. That is, if a site becomes known for propagating disinformation, for propagating untrustworthy information, advertisers really don't want to be linked to that. And with the shrinking of the advertising base, that may change things in unpredictable ways.
I think we've all been really struck by the impact of the Stop Hate for Profit campaign in getting advertisers to pull their ads. But I mean, there's an interesting conundrum here, which is that I really hope those big companies, particularly the likes of Coke and Adidas, they continue that. But can they afford to be off Facebook for too long? Can the combined weight of the ad industry and the big brands make a real sustained stand that will make Facebook change?
Well, that's an unknown, because I don't know if advertisers find the big social media platforms as effective advertising media. I plain don't know. I like using some of the big social media platforms. My favorite and most effective is Twitter. On the other hand, my brother, who's only come to use Facebook in his 60s, loves Facebook. And that is really good. I just need to see, I think advertising may not be the dominant means of paying for social media or entertainment or news in the future. These models are evolving. I'm trying to play a role in this and might play an increased role next year, assuming there still is a functioning American and UK democracy.
Right. Are you going to buy TikTok?
TikTok, I've seen good things done with it, but I think it's for the youngs. And I haven't been a member of the youngs ever.
But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting situation with TikTok. I mean, various rumors about who might acquire it. Do you think this can be done? Can you break away a media brand from its parent company, bolt it onto another company, and make it a go of it? Do you think that's going to be possible?
I don't know. I can only hope it's done in good conscience. And from internal discussions, I have a fair amount of confidence that Microsoft could do it in good conscience.
Okay, well, that's good. Craig, it's been wonderful to talk to you on the podcast and cover such a wide variety of topics and been very generous with your time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Infotagen podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, and featuring Craig Newmark and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagen, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagen.com, or using hashtag isolate the lies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you until next time.